This show is a proud member of the Dice Tower Network, the Justice League of board game podcasts. Find out more at dicetower.com.
And welcome to another episode of the Family Gamers Podcast. This is episode 237, and because it's an odd-numbered show, we have a guest.
You jumped right into it.
I did.
I'm supposed to say that part.
No!
All right. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Family Gamers Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Andrew, and I'm joined by my lovely and wonderful wife, Anitra.
And interrupting
wife, Anitra.
That's me.
Anitra is telling the truth. We do have a guest on the show. We are super happy to invite back to the Family Gamers Podcast, Rory O'Connor. How are you doing today, Rory?
I'm good. I was about to jump in and tell you kids to stop squabbling.
I mean, we've been trapped inside with, you know, three other people for a year, more or less. So squabbling is just like part of every day. It's probably not too dissimilar from you, I'm guessing.
It's actually pretty much the same. And we had an added family member staying with us during lockdown, and they had to get used to that fact that, you know, we communicate through squabbling with each other and sarcasm.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's... We went shopping for a countertop. We were looking at quartz countertops last week. And right in the middle of it, we were fake squabbling about some countertop. And right in the middle, the lady who was helping us, her name was Terry. I looked at Terry and I said, "Terry, what do you think?"
And she's like, "Oh no,
no.
I'm not getting in the middle of this.
I'm not getting in the middle of this.
I know better."
Exactly. Well, it is episode 237 of the Family Gamers Podcast, which means I have a fact about the number 237. Okay, here we go. Rory, have you seen the movie The Shining?
A long time ago, yes.
A long time ago. Okay, so here's a fact about the number 237 that has to do with The Shining. So the movie took place at the Timberland Lodge in Oregon. And in the book, The Shining, everything happens in room 217. But the Timberland Lodge actually requested that for the movie, they change the number to 237. I mean, Timberland Lodge was used for, I don't think it was actually set at the Timberland Lodge, but it was used for a lot of the pictures. And so, like, people would go there and be like, "It's the hotel from The Shining." So the deal is that basically the lodge's management asked for the room number to be changed so that guests wouldn't avoid room 217, which was an actual room at the lodge.
Okay, I thought it was going to be the opposite, where like 237 was like the deluxe suite, and so people would want to like book into that one.
So no, there is no room 237 at the hotel, and that's why they picked that number. The website of the Timberline Lodge notes, curiously and somewhat ironically, room 217 is requested more than any other room at Timberline.
Interesting.
Which is kind of weird.
A little creepy.
But yeah, so that's my fact about the number 237. It's in the movie The Shining. It is not a real place, courtesy of the Timberline Lodge.
All right. Good.
That's it. If you're looking to go on vacation, maybe you need some money. And a good way to save your money is by talking to a financial planner.
Sure. So we'd like to thank our sponsor, First Move Financial. If you find yourself in a situation where your credit has taken a hit, you've got a difficult hole to dig out of, but it's not impossible. The two most important things to start doing, if you aren't already, is to pay all your bills on time and pull your credit reports from annualcreditreport.com. You get a report from each of the three bureaus once a year for free. So, space them out, don't pull them all at once. On your credit reports, you're looking for errors, forgotten accounts, and your payment history.
The best way to improve your score is a good payment history, so keeping up with where you are on your credit report is going to help you track your progress. Finally, if you need more help, you should seek out a qualified credit counselor. Most work for organizations that will try to push you into a debt management plan. You should try to avoid this if you can, and just work with the credit counselor to come up with a budget and a plan to pay down your debts. A debt management plan is better than a bankruptcy, but you do need to be aware and informed about what you're getting into. There's a link in the show notes for the FTC's website with information about credit counseling and debt management plans for anybody who wants to learn more.
Remember, you can always schedule a short phone call by going to firstmovefinancial.com/familygamers. And even if they aren't the right fit to help you, they can point you in the right direction.
Thanks so much to First Move Financial for sponsoring this episode of the show.
All right. We are super happy to have Rory on the show again with us. Thank you, Rory.
It's a pleasure.
And as always, we're going to start off by talking about a few games that we've been playing lately.
So Rory streams a lot of his playing of games online, which I'll drop in and watch a little bit, and then I have to like go to work because it's at like 8:30 or 9 o'clock in the morning for me, and of course you're in Ireland. So talk a little bit about what you've kind of been doing online. I mean, we'll get into this in more detail in the second half of the show, but obviously this is what you've been playing, so talk about that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't actually get to play much games, and most of it, my time is spent, like, playtesting, so I kind of use that as an excuse to play games. So, Michael and I, every Friday, have been playing Prisma Arena and actually testing out new MoCon and new characters and new cards for the game. When I'm not doing that online, I'm usually trying to play Marvel Champions solo on my own, or Test of Honor, which is a samurai-themed miniatures game, which I've absolutely fallen in love with because of the gameplay and the period. And I've, since lockdown, I've built up quite a collection of figures and terrain that I've been procrastinating and painting.
All right, very cool.
Yeah, I have seen a lot of those miniatures that you're posting painted pictures of, and I painted one miniature in college, and I keep telling myself that's like a cool hobby to get into, but like it's a bad idea.
You don't need
idea.
Any more hobbies.
I don't need.
You need fewer hobbies.
But I do want to pause for a second. So you said new MoCons and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Is there something we need to know?
Well, I mean, there's a. Because it's part of what we will kind of hopefully chat about later. I mean, there's a. In my head, there's a big world in Prisma Arena, and I explored that in November. We'll maybe talk about that later. And so, you know, in the base game of Prisma Arena, there's 8 MoCon or 8 emotions, but we all know there are more than 8 emotions to be experienced in the world. So in preparation for the day when...
when there's the phone call comes.
Yeah, when there's enough, yeah, from me. So when we kind of hopefully are back and more people have seen the game and are playing it, we've been developing new MoCon and new combo cards to include in the game.
Very cool.
Oh, neat.
I'm excited about that. All right, let's talk about some other stuff. So, Anitra, we have been playing some Jurassic Parts.
We have. I think everyone in our family has now gotten a chance to play this, although not all at the same time. But it has been really cool to try the different ways of splitting apart this giant tableau of dinosaur fossils. And this almost area control type idea of you want to have the most chisels when a split finally happens. Because if you have the most chisels, you get half of the pieces. If you have the second most, you get half of what's left. And if you've got the third most, you get half of what's left after that. So, I mean, it is nice every once in a while to dart in there and put, like, a single chisel and be like, oh, I got a couple of pieces.
Yeah.
But most of the time, you're really fighting for first place so you can have a really good choice. Mm-hmm. It's also got that set collection element of you're trying to create specific dinosaur fossils with specific pieces. But it is definitely possible to do well without collecting a lot of sets, because there's things like plant fossils that are just worth more the more of them you have, and a couple little one-point fossils here and there that are a single tile.
Mm-hmm. Have you had a chance to play this, Rory?
No, like my game playing has actually been incredibly limited over the last year. It's been mostly Marvel Champions, a little bit of Cacao with my family, and not a whole lot else. It's been a lot of solo gaming.
Yeah, this is a really interesting one. We talked a little bit about it last week, but I'm enjoying it a lot.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorites from this publisher. So
one of the nice things I'm realizing the more we play with Jurassic Parts is it's one of those games that feels very similar at 2 players, at 3 players, at 4 players. And it theoretically goes up to 5, but we haven't tried pulling our youngest in to play it with 5 players. But you know, it gets a little bit tighter, but the overall feeling is the same, which is nice because I don't see that in a lot of games that scale from 2 to 5 players. You know, they're usually a very different experience with the different player counts. So we also talk about how we do some games as part of my homeschooling of our middle child. And we finally got around to playing Periodic, a game of elements, which I think has been sitting on our shelf of opportunity for a year, maybe?
I got it from PAX Unplugged in the math trade. So
yeah,
that would
so
be
a year
2019.
And a half.
Yeah, 2019.
Yeah. But we finally got around to playing it. And I'm really enjoying it. It is the right level of educational to play with an older elementary kid or a middle school kid or even a high schooler, because it's really just going to get you more familiar with the periodic table as you move around on it. You're trying to collect various elements, which are determined by goal cards that get pulled randomly. And I have to reassure people that it is way less complicated than it looks like.
What's the general mechanic of the game?
So the general mechanic of the game is there are, I think, 6 movement choices at the bottom of the board. And every turn, you can either pick one of those movement choices and take all of the tokens off it and just do that one movement. You always get to choose anywhere from 1 to 5 spaces. Or if you want to be able to do multiple movements, you pay 1 token for the first movement, 2 tokens for the second movement, 2 tokens for the third movement.
Yeah.
So it's really just about utilizing these different styles of movement. It's, you know, change atomic number and then like change the electron shell, various aspects. So you can go, you know, up, down, left, right. Some let you go up and left. Some let you go up and right.
So it's kind of like a movement action selection kind of thing.
Yeah, it definitely is.
I actually, was talking to the designers, and what I really liked about that use of the tokens was that it kind of follows that idea of, you know, energy can't be destroyed. It can only be like chains, because if I understand correctly, there's like a fixed pool of those tokens. So they're just constantly being repurposed in different ways. And I thought that was a nice twist that it's not often you get a game with a fixed pool of like tokens that you're able to work with.
Is there like an entropy mechanic in this game?
There is not an entropy mechanic.
I'm so disappointed.
Actually, in a 2-player game, there are a few times when you might be able to add a little bit of energy to the system.
Right.
But energy is never taken away from the system.
Entropy is my spirit energy?
Yes,
can I say
it
that?
Is.
Actually, that's kind of an interesting idea. Oh, I think that could be developed. Not by me, I'm not smart enough. But so let's talk about something else. So last night we sat down with another one of these kind of escape room things from DV Gyochi, which is Deckscape, The Mystery of El Dorado. So a couple of weeks ago, we talked about a Decktective that we did, which was kind of solving this mystery. And you take some of the cards, these kind of oversized cards, and you build a almost like a panorama with a nested box lid in the box bottom. And you're looking through that and you're going through these cards.
And then you're also deciding to play some cards and discard other cards.
Yeah.
And this was not quite as engaging as that.
Yeah. So, I mean, we'll talk about it in our snap review, which is going to be during the break of this show. But I think that coming into this with the expectations that we had from Decktective, we were, I think, a little bit disappointed. It definitely tried to give you the illusion that you had branching paths and decisions to make. But ultimately, at the end of the day, you pretty much had to do everything.
Yeah, I think it does compare favorably with, like, Unlock, which is the other card-based escape room that we've played, though. Because those tend to be also very linear, but in a less obvious way, I guess. Because the whole idea with Deckscape is you've got this deck of cards in front of you, and you're like, okay, well, I'm not supposed to touch any of these cards. I'm really just looking at the top card of the deck, and I have to solve this puzzle with whatever cards and resources I already have. And once I do, I can flip it over and also see what's underneath it.
Right.
Whereas with Unlock, it's always this random, like, oh, take this random card from over here and this random card from over here. So I did like that Deckscape gave you more choices by showing you really where you were going more clearly than Unlock does.
Yeah, I definitely felt like Deckscape tried to carry a narrative thread through the game a lot stronger than an Unlock box. An Unlock box is pretty contrived and pasted on. Like, the theme exists to provide theme to the puzzles, not to really give you, like, a means to an end kind of thing, if you know what I mean. Like,
yeah,
with Deckscape, it's telling you a story as you work through these logic puzzles. Unlock is just like, you know, get out. And the theme is pirate stuff, so there's going to be parrots and peg legs in your puzzles.
Or whatever.
You know what I mean?
Well, in this, The Mystery of El Dorado, it seemed like a couple of the puzzles were almost pasted on. Like, oh, we have this theme. We can stick this puzzle in here. But overall, it worked.
Yeah, it did. I mean, I think we gave Detective 5 out of 5.
Yeah.
I mean, so that's what we were coming into this Deckscape thing with, which is almost unfair. So we were a little bit disappointed with it. It was still fun. I mean, these things are not expensive. It's an escape room for an hour and a half of entertainment. It's pretty cheap, you know, for your family. So that's that. And you'll hear a little bit more about that in the break for the show.
All right. And we have one more.
Okay.
Which Rory will be happy to hear. We have been playing a ton of Combo Clash.
Yeah.
I see the
So for those of you who don't know, Combo Clash is the newest offering from Hub Games. I don't think it's officially out yet.
No, not yet. April 30th.
April 30th. So we'll be timing our review around that. But I'm just going to say now, go ahead and pre-order it.
It's good, guys. And it's important to know that we were able to teach our 6-year-old how to play after the 10-year-old and the 12-year-old really got into it. We pulled the 6-year-old in it, and with enough reinforcement from the rest of us, he was like, oh, okay, yeah, I see this now. So it took a little bit longer for him to get the hang of it, but he definitely got it and enjoyed it and didn't do too poorly.
And here's what I'll say about Combo Clash. First of all, the art is amazing. It's like you're playing a comic book. It's so fun. And obviously all the comboing is super fun. Elliot at 6 obviously isn't going to be able to see 2-3 combos down the line or anything like that. But one of the big things that we talk about with him is that we like to play a lot of games that mitigate his ability to be the agent of chaos.
His rather chaotic style. Yes. Yeah.
Well, you can't really do that with Combo Clash because everybody's playing on a common board. But it's so easy to understand that once he understood the game, it really wasn't a problem anymore.
Yeah, even if he's not making optimal decisions, he's certainly not, you know, setting up the person next to him to be like, oh, I'm going to keep handing you big old combos. Right.
Or it's not, you know, he's not trashing the board. There's no real way to kind of do something like that. You know, there's games that we'll play where he'll do something because he thinks it's funny or whatever, and it'll just make everyone's life miserable for the next 3 or 4 turns, and everybody gets grumpy with him.
So, and that's not going to happen.
That's not going to happen here. I really love the rollout board. I don't know. We're just having a good time with it. We're really enjoying our time with Combo Clash.
See, I would argue
for the opportunity.
I would argue that chaos would actually help him to limit your ability to score and work in his favor. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, but he's also got to be able to get some points, too. It's the, you know, whoever wins the most points wins the game. Isn't that, that's John Madden who said that, I think. Whoever scores the most points wins the game. So, I don't know. But you know what? The important thing is we can set the 3 kids up with it at this point and walk away.
I mean, we like playing it, too, but I'm always excited to see a game that we like playing, but that our kids will play happily without us. And Prismarina was the same way. Mm-hmm. We certainly enjoy playing it, but our kids took that and ran with it.
Yeah, but that was just the 2 older ones. This brings it back a little bit.
This styles it a little bit younger.
Yeah, so we're having a lot of fun with that. Did Claire actually finish drawing that picture of the crocodile or whatever it was that she was drawing?
No, but she was trying to copy some style elements from the wolves in Jake Parker's art. So we really, really appreciate that art.
So there's a little fun fact. You know, they're all animals, you know, 8 animals, but we made a point of 4 of them being female. Special prize if you can find them.
I don't know, man. They all look like animals to me.
We'll see what we can figure out. But Claire is very smart and artistic and... Yeah, so she will bring either a drawing pad or a book to the table when we play a board game. She will read in between turns.
Or she will draw in between
turns. She doesn't have one of these cell phone things, so she's not doing that, but she's just nonstop. I only have myself to blame.
It bothers me, but I always tell myself at least she's playing the game with us and not being like, no, I don't want to. Because it could very easily go that direction instead.
All right, well, why don't we do this? Why don't we welcome our members to the Family Gamers community? We have four new members this week. I want to say welcome to Nathan Boster. Welcome to the community. Hope you're having a good time in there.
Philip Zook, Nick Lowe.
And that's like a cool DJ name.
Nick Lowe.
What's up? My name's Nick Lowe. I like it.
And Renell King. Welcome to the community.
All right, and with that, we are going to take a quick break, and you are going to hear all about that Deckscape, The Mystery of El Dorado. And when we come back, we are going to talk all about storytelling with Rory. After years of research and searching, you have concluded the legend of El Dorado is, in fact, just a myth. But wait, unexpectedly, the Amazon holds one last clue to the mystery of El Dorado.
This is a snap review for Deckscape, The Mystery of El Dorado. This is a pocket escape room by Martino Chiacchiera and Silvano Sorrentino. It's published by DV Giochi and intended for one all the way up to six players, ages 12 and up. In this Deckscape game, you'll gradually work your way through the 60-card deck, solving puzzles and gaining clues to the mystery of El Dorado.
Boom, boom, boom.
So let's talk about the art in this game.
Alberto Bontempi's art is clear, but sometimes I think it's a little more cartoony than we kind of want it to be. Some cards held clues to various puzzles, while others presented choices. Some did both. The only clues we didn't really get, air quote, were thankfully not the only way to solve their particular puzzles.
Some of the card-based puzzles were really, really small, which made it challenging for us to solve them together in a group. They were really only visible by one person at a time.
There's a folded-up piece of paper in the game that held the key to several puzzles, but it still felt like it was serving its job. You'll understand if you play. It wasn't just some contrived picture that was really just there to serve the puzzles. That was a nice change from some of the other escape boxes we've tried. So let's talk about the mechanics of Deckscape.
Deckscape feels a bit like a choose-your-own-adventure book in the form of a deck of cards. You're going to move forward through the deck and solve puzzles as you come to them. Once you think you've solved a puzzle, flip the card over to find the solution.
What this means is sometimes you'll find a card that will give you some options on where to go next. It'll instruct you to take this stack and put it in one pile, a second stack and put it in a second pile, and maybe a third stack into a third pile, which gives you this idea of branching paths. Choose your own adventure.
Because of the way it's structured, most of the puzzles in the game can only be attempted once. We only found one exception to this rule. Discuss the puzzle as a group and make sure that you've decided on an answer before you flip the card.
Sometimes you'll pick up helpful items that will assist in later on puzzles, and some puzzles will require the use of specific items. Here and there you'll find hints or hint cards available to you from earlier puzzles. Some of them are more obvious than others.
If the group fails a puzzle, you'll take a penalty, either Z's or X's. Z penalties represent hunger and tiredness and are easier to remove. Don't forget to use pencil to record these. X's count against your score at the end of the game.
Once you get to the end of the deck, the game is over. Record how long it took you to finish the deck and add your penalties. Then compare yourself to the chart. How were you at solving the mystery? So, Anitra, what did we expect from Deckscape, The Mystery of El Dorado?
Well, based on the name, we expected a card-based escape room.
I think it even says it's essentially an escape room on the box.
Yeah.
It was pretty reasonable to expect that.
It does differ from the card-driven unlock games, which are also escape rooms, but it still had some of the same shortfalls. It's hard for more than two people to study a single card to get your clues.
So we had to pass cards around the table, and this actually negatively impacted our completion time at the end.
Yeah, there was a lot of passing cards for puzzles that were a little bit more complex, and then the puzzles that were easier, the first person who saw the card solved them and just passed the card around the table saying, does this look right?
Well, we wanted everyone to feel included, so there you go. After playing Detective Bloody Red Roses, you can see our snap review for that, we were hopeful that this would have more in common with that style of play than the typical look-for-this-card escape box.
We were looking forward to finding out what this deck of cards and paper brochure had in store for us.
So based on those expectations, what surprised us about this Deckscape game?
Well, first of all, this Deckscape felt way more like a story than a lot of the other escape room games that we've played. There was a real narrative here with goals that changed slightly over the course of the game.
That's right. We talked briefly before about the unlock games, which are app-driven. Deckscape has no app. It is purely the deck of cards. But the narrative story in Deckscape definitely carried through better than what we would experience in those games.
For the entirety of this game, you're lost in the Amazon jungle. So it shouldn't be a surprise that bad things keep happening to you. However, when we found a card that said, "You are lost," our daughter playing with us just sent, okay.
Ultimately, we love escape boxes, but there's something to be said for the lack of immersion. You're sitting at your dining room table, you can't change that. So we're not going to be fully immersed and have the gravitas of being hopeless, which is what that's trying to evoke.
As we mentioned earlier, you'll split out portions of the deck after solving the first puzzle. This structure makes it look like there are branching paths where you need to choose a path to go down. But in reality, you'll need to visit everything or nearly everything.
And honestly, the order matters. If you solve a puzzle correctly but without the necessary items, air quote, you'll still take a penalty. Fortunately, since we were playing this with the family, there were tons of places to get hints, which kept the difficulty level rather low. There are two side quests that give you a list of hints itemized by card number. Some of these were absolutely invaluable, and it made us happy that we had those cards available to us.
I thought for sure we'd be done with this Deckscape in an hour. But even though it never felt too difficult, it still took us right around 90 minutes. I didn't mind that, but it was a surprise. I'll make sure we allow enough time the next time we play one of these games.
Ultimately, it really boils down to how desperate you are to score well on this. We didn't rush through this either. We played it at a relatively relaxed pace, and again, we shared the cards around the table to make sure everybody felt included. If we were desperately trying to make it in under that 1 hour mark, we might have been able to do so.
All in all, we had really high hopes for Deckscape: The Mystery of El Dorado after playing Decktective: Bloody Red Roses. So it might not be fair to measure this Deckscape game against that. We did like it more than most of the unlock boxes that we've played.
Well, you liked it more than most of the unlock boxes that we've played. I actually prefer the unlock system a little bit, but I did enjoy the narrative flow that moved through this Deckscape box a little bit better because it felt like a more cohesive story, not just scaffolding for puzzles. One more thing I do want to add. We're comparing this to Unlock and not necessarily the exit boxes because this is not a destructible game. This is a game that you can move on to someone else after you're done playing with it.
Just like Unlock.
Yep.
So, Andrew, what would we rate Deckscape: The Mystery of El Dorado?
Well, it was fun. So for an enjoyable time, even though there were a few bumps along the way, we rate Deckscape: The Mystery of El Dorado 3.5 golden treasures out of 5. And that's Deckscape: The Mystery of El Dorado
in a snap. And we're back. As previously mentioned, we're here with Rory O'Connor, and we're going to talk about some storytelling, primarily using games that you've helped design and put out through Hub Games, but maybe through some other things as well.
Yeah, I'm not averse to talking about other games as well.
Well, one of the things that I find super cool, and really what kicked this process off, and it's been, at least in my mind, slowly building over like the last probably month or two, is that you were using the Untold board, which by necessity requires that you're using Rory's story cubes, mm-hmm. to tell a story with the characters from Prisma Arena, which is something that you alluded to before. And this is before you went into the whole D&D thing. So we could talk about that as well. But like that whole process, I think there's something very instrumental to that. And maybe we could talk a little bit about how parents can look at the stuff that's on their shelf and figure out how to tell stories with that stuff. Or even at its most rudimentary level, like, how do you start with something like Rory's Story Cubes and start to tell that story? And just, I don't know, I'd love to hear your take on that because I love the way that you blended everything together.
So, I mean, I have to caveat, like, I don't consider myself like a storyteller, but I love stories and I love play. That's like, if there's one thing that's key to my life, it's play and kind of like escaping grown-up reality as well.
I think escaping has been a big thing lately.
Yeah.
For the last year or so.
And so there's something magical about seeing a story emerge out of nothing. I think that's why I like Avery Story Cubes, I like Untold, I like playing, experiencing role-playing games, and often I'm happy to do them solo, because I just want to see something emerge from it, and to go, wow, that didn't exist before. You know, it's a bit like making games. They didn't exist before, they suddenly exist, and you're like, we had a hand in that. So with Rory Story Cubes, like, for anyone who says they can't tell a story, like, let's kind of start there. I would say to people, and this comes from Scott McLeod. I managed to talk to him. He was the creator of Zot and in creating comics, which is an amazing work on kind of how comics function as media. And he said, well, if you can lie, you're telling a story.
Okay.
It's true.
Yeah. That's a good perspective.
So that's a starting point. It's like, you're a storyteller. Because you tell lies. And with story cubes, like, we tried to describe it. If you roll the story cubes and you just look for the first thing that grabs your attention, and you start to tell any kind of story, it doesn't matter how much sense it makes. But you imagine like you're a child running down a hill where you're running so fast, you have to keep going, because if you try to stop, you'll fall over. And so that idea ties in with training I did with Wynne Wenger, who sadly passed away recently. But it's this idea of outrunning your conscious mind, that critical part of you that's telling you that's dumb, that's silly, that doesn't work, it doesn't make sense. So that kind of motif of running down a hill is you running so fast, that critical part of you can't catch up. And what invariably happens, and I've tested this like so many times with people, is you'll see this moment in them telling a story with Rory Story Cubes where like the tone of it just changes. And it's like they've been swept up by the story and the story starts telling through them. It's kind of how I describe it. Because you can see how they were trying to think and plan and organize the whole thing. And then suddenly the story is just kind of flowing through them. And it's just kind of like exercise. The more you do that and the more you practice it, you know, the easier that process becomes. That idea of launching yourself off that ledge and allowing yourself to just see what happens.
Yeah, I think there's something to be said for children and the way children tell stories, because they don't have a lot of the inhibition that adults do with a lot of these, you know, ways to determine whether or not things are appropriate, we'll say.
Yeah.
And it's so interesting to watch, like, our boys, and they'll make some story, and then I do this, and then I do that, and they get progressively more ridiculous. But they only get progressively more ridiculous to me. They don't get progressively more ridiculous to them.
They don't really
and
have
that's because they're inside the story.
Yeah, they don't really have the same feeling we do that the story needs to make sense or feel realistic or whatever. It's just what they're thinking of, and they spit it on out and see what comes.
Well, I think that's what you're saying, Rory. Is like it doesn't need to make like who made the rule that the story has to make sense, right? Like that's kind of the whole point.
There was some training I did a while ago about kind of, and I had to kind of read about dream therapy, about a dream therapist who worked with people. And they made a fascinating point. They said when someone would come in for therapy and they didn't have dreams, he would just say, just tell me about your day. Because he said, no matter what story you tell or narrative you give, you can't help but reflect what's going on for you. And so there's this idea of like, we're constantly telling stories and we're constantly showing something of ourselves in the stories we tell. So to me, when your children are telling stories, you're still kind of like unconsciously exploring ideas and testing things and seeing how they show up. And it's always fascinating to look back at things and see, oh, hang on, yeah, that was kind of going on in my life at that point. Or, you know, and I've become aware enough now that I notice it when I'm starting to tell a story and I'm like, whoa, that's a bit close to the bone.
Okay, so let's bring this a little bit more into this particular example, because the first time I think that I really got a sense that Hub Games was all about storytelling was probably Let's see if I remember this correctly. I think Michael had like sprained his ankle or something, and he had his foot propped up, and he was playing Untold at PAX Unplugged a couple of years ago. I have this mental image in my head, and there was something about like professional wrestlers taking over the world, and it was so ridiculous that it really stuck with me, obviously, because this was, I think, the first year of PAX Unplugged.
Yeah, that would be like 2017.
I don't know. Maybe
2016?
I'm mixing. I don't know, but
I don't know.
I'm certain that he, you know, sprained his ankle or something, and I thought it was that year, but now that I reflect on it, maybe not, but I don't know.
And that's how good stories are told.
I guess. But
stick it all together in your
but
head.
But I, you know, it was so silly and so ridiculous, but you could see the genuine excitement in these, I don't know, these guys must have been mid-20s, and exactly this thing that you're talking about, where it's like the story is getting ahead of them, and it's like, oh, what about this happening, or this happening? And, you know, just watching the narrative bounce around like a ping pong ball between the people that were sitting around the table. And that was really, really cool. And Untold gives that engine that says, well, not really, or it provides just enough external input to put scaffolding around driving the narrative forward, right? Which I really, really like. And so that's why, and we talked about that in our Untold review whenever we did that, and that's why I thought it was so clever that you were taking the Prisma Arena MoCons, which there's kind of a story there, but there's not really a lot in the Prisma Arena box to put it all together and to glue it together. And I thought it was so clever to take Untold and use that as the scaffolding that, I'm using air quotes when I say, was missing, because it wasn't really missing, from the Prisma Arena characters.
It was kind of interesting because in my head, when I walk to work every day, I'm trying to work out, like, what are the MoCon really? And what happens when the Spear departs the world and Hope finally awakens? Like, what happens? And I'm trying to work all this stuff out in my head because I have a need for a certain degree of consistency to the world that we're creating, you know, and because it also informs the gameplay as well. So as part of that, I would never actually allow myself to do more in Prisma Arena until we had finished the game. Because I was like, we have to get this game out the door, and I can't keep inventing new stuff for this game and exploring these ideas. It's like, I have to write the rule book. So if part of me is like, oh, well, I'll just write some, you know, develop some ideas. I'm like, no, get the rule book done. And to me, it kind of is a living, breathing world, but I'd never had the chance to explore it. And with NaNoWriMo coming up, which is the National Novel Writing Month, I thought, I do this like sometimes where I say to someone, oh, I'm thinking of doing this. And this happened with Michael, you know, a co-designer and colleague. And he said it live on a stream. Oh, Rory's going to be doing this thing. he said it on a...
Now.
Yeah, he said it on a BGG stream. And I was like, part of me was like, curse you, Michael. But at the same time, I kind of did it on purpose, you know, to kind of set myself up to make myself do it. So I committed to kind of telling a story every day using the framework. And it was to kind of show just how far you can push Untold. Because sometimes people think, oh, it's story cubes. It's kind of lighthearted. It's fun. The stories don't really make sense. And I was like, no, I'm going to tell a story that's going to run for literally 30 episodes. Each season is going to be 7 episodes and we're going to play through it. And for me, it was incredible because I literally had no idea. Like, my opening for the setting was like, you know, this is in the land of Sulis where, you know, the Spear walks the land and we're waiting for Hope to awaken. And our young heroes are, they hadn't even made it to Sulis to join the arena yet. They were kind of like off in the world and we were going to learn about them. And I just rolled the first set of story cubes and started telling the story to see what happened. And so it got to a point where, I mean, it's kind of interesting watching it because this time I got stuck, like, and I was trying to figure stuff out, but I also didn't allow the game to kind of take over. It was like, oh no, if this is a good idea, I'm going to figure out a way to make that fit in. But there's also moments where I'm like, you know, because I say something or I make a connection, I'm like, oh my god, this is when, like, I'm going to bring back this villain from this earlier episode and something's going to happen. And it's like, this is so cool. So there's that aspect of the emergent storytelling. I think that's the bit I really love. It's like, I don't know what's going to happen. And, you know, it helped me think more about the MoCon, how they function, and introduce, like, game-wise, to think more about some of the other people that live in Sulis as well. So in the, you know, in the base game, we kind of have what I call the Goldbot, which is the kind of Gollum robot character. So you actually learn about their origin in the adventure, which I'm kind of really, really happy with. But also just other kind of cultures as well, which I'm like, they'd be pretty cool as a character in like a future game as well.
All right.
But I also like this idea of your own stuff coming out. I explore the merchants trying to take advantage of something and people keeping secrets and narratives of the children being told to keep their place as well. You know, so I'm kind of watching myself deal with like process stuff as I'm telling it as well. And if you get to the very end, then I actually start experimenting with new tiles and reaction cards as well in the last three episodes for things that we could do with Untold in the future as well.
Very cool.
It's almost like therapy.
Well, I kind of have to set aside like 90 minutes each day. You know, they mostly ran for kind of 60 minutes, but it was like 10 a.m. every day. I have to be here and do this. You were probably the only person watching at the time, Andrew, but it kind of, yeah, it made me do it. And now I know I could do that again because I was terrified like the first time doing it. And, you know, talking to John Fury, the co-designer on this, who he really like gets the engine and how it works. So I was kind of going, John, am I doing it right? And I actually totally got something wrong in the first episode, but it helped me to become a better storyteller. I was like, all right, yes, now it makes a lot more sense.
You said something earlier, which I think was funny. You said that you had to finish the game and you didn't want anybody to suggest new stuff. I was listening to Board Games Insider. I don't know if you listen to that podcast, but one of the things I think it was Stephen Bonacore said was that there's two really, 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 really important people that both need to be present when making a board game. One of them is the designer and the other one is the producer, because without the producer, the designer will never stop designing. I thought it was funny then, and then to kind of hear you echo those sentiments, I thought was pretty interesting. And it really goes to that whole thing, which at least I've been seeing a lot of lately in the board game space, is a lot of talk about creatives and what is a creative, and how creative people just think differently. But that doesn't mean that non-create, I don't know what a creative capital C is really, but it doesn't mean that people that don't see themselves as creative can't be creative and tell stories. And that's what a lot of these tools help people do.
I think it's more to do with scope of interest. Like, I don't think there's anyone who's not creative. It's just where the scope and their bandwidth for that is. Like, for me, it's crucial, our team, like our product designer and graphic designer or project manager, that they input into the game, because it comes down to the components, the quality of it, how we get it to a certain price, and they come up with creative solutions that may not be obvious to people, but they're critical to the overall play experience. And also they have different interests in terms of games as well, so they kind of feed into it, because we're used to, we're gamers, but we're often designing games for people who aren't that traditional player, who have a lot of experience. So for me, like, it's taken some time, but that they've gotten much better at saying, Rory, stop, it's time to stop.
Well, why don't we talk a little bit about some of the other endeavors that we hinted at with storytelling. Andrew mentioned D&D. I have no idea why or what's going on with that, so would you mind enlightening me?
Sure. So it was actually, it came from a while ago. John, my co-designer, had answered some questions on BGG about incorporating Untold with the likes of Fate, the role-playing game.
Okay.
And how it could support that. And he had actually been, I'd been saying to myself for quite a while, I knew you could do this. And again, I was procrastinating, going, I want to sit down and do this. You'll notice the trend here. It's why I posted the picture, like, post on your page, was to kind of like catalyze myself into doing something about it. So I kind of reached out to John and said, oh, well, I'm going to do this and give it a try. And he said, this is perfect timing. I've been doing this for like months during lockdown. And so he told me what he had been doing with the game already. And so I'm essentially taking his framework and testing it. But again, bringing my perspective, which is like, John knows so much of D&D. He's been playing role-playing games for years. And, he play tested 5th edition. He played Pathfinder. Mm-hmm. And so my role is to kind of like question everything. So go, okay, I'm not that experienced.
Sure.
Where do I worry about getting into this game? Like, what's stopping me? What do I need to know? Where is there ambiguity? And I basically have started playing through a session of Untold and combining it with D&D. And so the way it essentially works is you create your setting at the beginning, like you normally would in the game, by answering the four questions. And then you flip the first tile and create the threat for the opening narrative. Sorry, and you will have created your characters beforehand. Sure. As well. And so you create the setting, and then in response to that, you're basically, you can ask questions like you'd normally do in the game, but now you might do a perception check to see whether you would spot that thing. Whereas in Untold, you just ask, is this happening? And you get to roll the dice. So you kind of have to do perception checks and tests to see whether you get to answer that question or not. You completely ignore all of the action tokens because all of the actions are going to be controlled by D&D. So once you set up the encounter or the opening scene, it's going to lead to an encounter of some kind. And the magic of what John has done, before I explain that, is he's taken a game of D&D and said it's essentially the same as an adventuring day in D&D. So if you play through a session of Untold, you're doing an adventuring day in D&D, which is a really tidy way of progressing your characters as well. So he went, okay, so there needs to be six encounters. This is where the encounters happen. Two by the time you get to the end of scene two, two by the time you get to the end of scene four, and then two harder ones by the time you get to the end of scene five. So it's that thing again of you're playing to find out what happens. And now theoretically, you can kind of do this as a group as well, like with parents and children. And what I think it's great for is like I'm getting to, and we will write this up properly for people, and I will do a live stream, and you'll see me fumbling through the books to try and work this out, because you know it's not as fast flowing as Untold. Untold is designed to like catapult you through it, so there is stopping and starting as you're looking at books and creating encounters, but it's really helping me to experience D&D and go, oh yeah, that's what you'd do here, and this is how you'd build an encounter. So it's actually a great way of learning to be a better DM, because Untold is giving you like the narrative structure, like because there's no messing around. It's like opening threat, you have an encounter, you have a second encounter, you discover something, you go to deal with that, you have an encounter. So it's kind of like cutscenes. It's cutting out all the fluff in between and propelling you through the narrative. And we were saying it's kind of showing you how to be a better DM as well. Mm. It's like just catapult these, focus on the story and the narrative, and be willing to kind of fudge things a little bit for the players for the sake of narrative as well. So yeah, I'm kind of on scene three where I've just fallen foul of some kobolds, and I'm going to have to deal with that when we finish this call to see what happens. But yeah, hopefully it'll allow people to experience like playing D&D solo, playing it cooperatively without a GM and without preparation. Like that's the thing. John has run, I think, about 100 encounters, he said, so far with this. And there's no preparation. You just sit down, you know, flip the first tile, and you get to be surprised about what happens.
So I mean, coming at this as someone who has played D&D and has gone through the min-max thing and, you know, full disclosure, Role Player is one of my favorite games of all time. So how do you strike the balance between doing all the stat stuff and not doing all the stat stuff? Like when you get into encounters and you know, range, like you just kind of like just hand wave it all, or I mean, how do you?
No. So to walk through it. So the first one was like, you know, John told me I made my life as difficult as possible, because the scene opens with our two heroes, which is a gnomish wizard and a dragonborn barbarian, traveling to the castle to deliver a message from the gnomish kingdom and the goblin kingdom that they've been visiting. But it opens with a giant is pursuing someone or something towards this castle, right? So I was immediately going, oh my God, like a giant. They can't, like their first encounter and it's a giant, they're dead, you know? So I decided to run with the story and see what would happen. So I decided, okay, they can't even try to kill this thing, right? So it's not a combat encounter. It has to be, they have to be smarter. And so I basically wrote down the giant's stats for it, rolled the dice and realized they were going to be scouts. they were scouts and they were being chased back, and they were riding on kind of panther axes, which were like giant panther mounts.
Sounds awesome.
So I just kind of copied the stats from them, wrote them down, and started the encounter from there. Right, rolled, and my characters came last in it, and I was like, oh, okay, so what would the giant do? Well, the giant is obviously trying to stop the scouts from getting to the castle. I've set that up. So their attack is a rock throw. So they throw a rock at the scouts, give the scouts advantage because they're moving fast away. They manage to survive it. So now it comes to my characters and I'm like, okay, well, what do we do? And my gnome has Firebolt. I'm like, I'm looking at the picture of the giant in the monster manual, and I went, maybe I could set fire to their loincloth and just distract them a little bit, because that's all I can hope for. So luckily I set fire. I did. I hit. I just went, it's on fire. And then I said, okay, I need to do some test for the giant. So I rolled, I think, a wisdom check to see whether it's smart enough to ignore the fire and go after the scouts. It failed. So it stops and starts putting out the fire, which buys the scouts some time to get ahead. And then it was like, back to the giant. He throws another rock. It hits. It kills one of the, you know, the amount of damage it did, it took out one of the scouts. So the rest of them are riding ahead. I ask a question using the D&D system. How do the scouts react to us helping them? And I rolled like a beer icon and a Red Riding Hood character. And I went, oh, well, the lead scout, Elwyn, she looks over and says, you know, last one back to the keep, buys the beer and keeps riding. And it doesn't stop the help. It just keeps going. So then I go, okay, my characters need to hide. Like, they just need to get away. So they run and hide, and I roll to see what it, you know, did a perception check. Is there anything for us to hide behind? And it says, yes, there is something. So I roll the story cubes to ask what it is. And I came up with, it's a prison carriage that's been knocked over and abandoned when they saw the giants coming. So our characters go and hide behind that. You know, and on John's advice, he was like, you need to end that encounter there, because you do anything else, you're dead. So, and because the game isn't tracking specific XP, it's like, if you get to the end of the adventure, you get the XP and you level up. So I'm not going, oh, I knocked out two characters and I get XP for that. But he did say you need to have two encounters. That's part of the mechanic, because D&D is all about using up resources. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I went, okay, so I'm hiding behind the cart. I looked, and a thug uses up about 100 XP for an encounter. And I thought, well, that's what I need to spend. So a prisoner bursts out from the prison cart and kind of yells, I'm not going back. You can't make me. And basically attacks the two characters, and they have to defend themselves against that escaped prisoner. So that was pretty hairy. The gnome kept missing with Firebolt. It just kept miscasting. And eventually, after the barbarian had wore them out, he or they rolled a crit on their Firebolt. I went, okay, they just blast them, and the dragonborn barbarian puts out the fire, ties them up, and leaves them there. And then we proceed to the next scene, which is, you know, the plot thickens. So we go and we talk to the scout that had been knocked off its pantherax, and we help it and we ask them questions, and that gives us information that leads us to scene 3. So that's why we're now facing these kobolds, because we went to the castle, and on our way to deliver a message to the king, I rolled the dice and I got a dragon icon, and I went, following John's advice, thinking about the level of challenge that I should be facing, and I went, we're being pursued by kobolds. And so I just rolled to see, you know, do our heroes know that they're being followed? So is it they're aware of it, or they get caught surprised? So they weren't aware. The kobolds got a 20. So it was like, so basically they basically like fall through a trap, and they end up in this underground cavern facing 5 kobolds, and that's literally where I stopped. So I have no idea what's going to happen. I have no idea where it's going to go.
So this, I mean, it really is a straight up marriage of the story cube / untold system with D&D, where from a stats perspective and all the mechanics, you're using the D&D system. Mm-hmm. From a narrative perspective, you're using Untold.
Yes, so Untold is as close to being the GM as possible. And I'm even, one of the things I'm trying to think about is like using things like the components that come in the game. So, you know, making use of the flashback token and the plus icons to give you like rerolls where possible, because you don't have a GM who's kind of fudging things a little bit. So It's like if something goes terribly wrong, you might roll a, you know, spend a reroll token to reroll that attack, or like a flashback to explain how you prepared something to aid you in that moment as well. Mm-hmm. And I also want to really incorporate the reaction cards in terms of how you like meeting NPCs, because it's one thing I want to experiment with as I'm playing, is how to bring out more of the social interaction side, because that's one thing I know people are drawn to the core of Untold, is because it's narrative led, it's not combat led. So I want to draw out more of the narrative aspect. Like I could do it with when I meet the kobolds. Let's just try it here because I have it right beside me. So we meet the kobolds and I'm going to shuffle a reaction card to see how they're reacting. Okay, so I've got, you can see this. So they're laughing, right? So they're laughing hilariously at the fact that we fell for their trap. So it's just like these little things that set it up, because it means then, oh, they're confident. So maybe they're going to be overconfident in how they're behaving. So
yeah, it can give you more flavor for, you know, what's actually happening here. Like if you fell into the trap and you pulled a different card, like the sad face, well, maybe the kobolds weren't trying to trap you after all. They were trying to trap somebody entirely different.
Exactly. Yeah. And that, you know, it just adds texture to the story, because I think that's the hardest thing. And I have to give credit to Tom Scott, who wrote a zine called DM Yourself. He was trying to show how you could use existing like settings and modules and solo roleplay them. And he tries really hard to help players immerse themselves in the narrative by thinking about the senses. So you'd roll a D6, it represents a sense, and you think about the scene using that sense. I don't think you need to do that with Untold, because it's with the story cubes, it's setting so much of it up. But any little moment that allows you to have immerse yourself more in the story and make the scene be less foggy in your imagination and more concrete, I think is a, you know, a positive thing.
Sure.
Well, I have really been enjoying it. I mean, obviously lately I've been falling off the Watch Rory stream wagon because of work, but it is what it is. But I had a lot of fun watching you tell the Prisma Arena character stories with the Untold system. And this sounds like just about the coolest thing ever. Merging D&D with the narrative element, which I would, you know, would always want to prepare and never have time to, kind of thing, which obviously is a huge potential value add for any parents out there who have wondered this exact thing, like how do you run this stuff, this kind of stuff for your kids, and this is a tool that allows someone who maybe is D&D friendly but doesn't have the time to prep all the stuff to have the mechanics available to them. And not have to kill themselves to get it all.
And there's no disappointment that things didn't go the way you planned, because it's like it's always going to go the way, you know, you'll never do more preparation than what's needed. And like the fun thing is I find myself flicking through the book and looking at the kobolds, but then I'm seeing like another race beside them. I'm kind of going, huh. Maybe, again, it's this, like, your brain is taking in all this stuff and filtering it, and it'll come out later. So the next time I see, like, a raven icon on story cubes, I might be like, oh, let's bring in that bird race that I saw in the book. And that's one thing John is really pro with this. It's like, use it to meet the characters and do the stuff that you want to do in D&D. Like, have fun with it. Yeah. So, like, have you had a trap encounter? Okay, well, let's like make a trap for yourself to run up against. Or, you know, he really wanted to explore using mounts. So he gave one of his characters a mount. And now he gets to learn the rules of how that works. Or if you want to go to the outer planes or something, just have that happen. And then
do it.
You get, which is kind of weird because we're kind of used to being told, you know, how we should do something.
Well, that was great. Thanks so much for talking with us, Rory. This is fascinating. And as somebody who... I think I identify a lot with what you've been saying about really enjoying stories and storytelling, but not necessarily feeling like I'm great at it myself. You have inspired me to go out there and try again.
We'll and I think that's ultimately what we wanted to do with this is, you know, I mean, obviously, Rory, you've been doing this kind of stuff for a very long time. You've been doing story cubes and Untold and, you know, even things like Blank, where there's a very organic element to that game and all this stuff. So you've got a lot of experience with this. And I mean, I just think this is something that a lot of parents kind of want to do. And I think we've seen that undercurrent of desire in the various online communities that we're in, where parents are really looking for, I want to say, ways to entertain their kids, but ways to do this kind of stuff, because a lot of us grew up with D&D or some other kind of role-playing system in our lives, and we don't really know how to translate that. And, mm-hmm. and you get the default answer, oh, go get Stuffed Fables, or go get Mice and Mystics, or No Thank You Evil, or whatever. But in a world where you're able to create whatever you want, there are infinite possibilities, not like six.
I think I'm kind of good at creating the systems for other people to play with, and more so than people who create these worlds for other people to play in. Like, I actually don't want that. Like, I have my idea. Like, this is a very kind of like fairy tale-ish Germanic, you know, Scandinavian setting. Because to me, when I think fantasy, that's what I think of. I kind of grew up with, you know, mm-hmm. Warhammer, which has this kind of grimmer feel to it than the high fantasy that we get with D&D. So being able to play in the world that you want and, you know, have that happen is great. And I think also one of the frustrations, because I did try to play D&D with my three daughters and we played a few sessions. But again, there was this thing in my head about how it should work. Like mm-hmm. what's mm-hmm. meant to happen in a session, and getting like frustrated for no proper reason with when right. they tried to do something different or they didn't understand, you know, how you're meant to fantasy, you know, kind of, you know, because I realized they'd no exposure to kind of goblins and elves, you know, that whole history, because they never read Lord of the Rings and had no interest in it. So I think what this does, I'd really encourage people to play in a world of their own creation and think about combining it with the likes of Untold, and even just playing with Untold straight, is that there's no restriction on that, and you can't kind of be wrong in the world, because if you want something to happen, it'll happen, and you won't get frustrated that I put all this effort into something and it didn't come to pass because the kids went off in a different direction. The story gives you the handrail, and everything that happens is what was meant to happen in the story.
I mean, I've had this thought kind of over and over again as we've talked, and I mean, that is a joke that we always see, right? Is like, the DM creates this, you know, wonderful story, and every 3 seconds in, you know, everything goes sideways. But, you know, you said it, and it sounds so silly to put into words this idea that this isn't the proper way that you're supposed to make believe and play pretend.
Yeah.
Which we all laugh when I say it, but that's exactly the way that so many people, and us included,
yeah.
you know,
oh, yeah.
respond. Right, and you alluded to it with D&D. It's like, well, you know, you were getting frustrated because they weren't playing pretend correctly, which when you say it out loud sounds so dumb. Mm-hmm. And yet we all do it.
Yeah.
And that's something that I think is really, really interesting about the way that you've combined these systems and the way that you approach this stuff and the different ways in which you're proposing storytelling happens, because it really reinforces, no, pretend is just pretend, and you can just kind of pretend the way you want to pretend, which again, sounds ridiculous, but is totally true. And it also removes a lot of barriers of entry.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said before, I'd love to DM for my kids, but I don't have time to. Well, I don't really need to have all of this time to invest if I go with a much more organic system.
And here's just a thought, and like, I have to give so much credit to John. Like, he's the brains behind all of this, and he's, you know, as a teacher himself, you know, very pro, you know, have fun with it and enjoy it. I mean, well, you could sit down, because there's some basic maths in the game that John has worked out. You know, you have to have encounters that are a certain number of XP for the characters playing. But you could ask the kids to go, who are we going to have the encounter with? Like, have a flick through the monster manual and find who we're going to have an encounter with. You just need to make sure that the total adds up to this amount, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. And so you can actually take some of the legwork off yourself and sit back, and maybe you help with crafting the story side of it. So you can make it a much more cooperative, shared experience as well, mm-hmm. so that it might give them the confidence in future to be the DM with the straight D&D system afterwards.
Right.
Yeah.
I love it. Unfortunately, I think we are probably about out of time. Mm-hmm. For us, it's almost dinner time. For you, it's almost bedtime. So I think that we're probably going to have to press pause here. But where can people find your stuff online? Where can they find these live streams? Where can they see all this stuff?
The live streams are all on the Hub Games YouTube channel. So it's We Are Hub Games on YouTube. And I've created a playlist for Prism Arena when I start live streaming the D&D, when I've worked it out. You know, I'll create a playlist to record them there as well. So I kind of put things out through a mix of under my own name of Rory O'Connor on Twitter, but also then through We Are Hub Games, which is the name we use across most channels as well. Yeah, and I'm happy to answer questions, and because it helps me kind of work out what's needed as well. So if people want to do this and they're struggling with it, hit me up and by you asking questions, it'll help me be clearer in terms of what's needed to help more people get started as well.
I love this idea that you've mentioned, I think, twice now, where you've committed to doing something without knowing whether or not you could do it to force yourself to do it.
Yeah.
I'm that's me to a T. That's the kind of thing that... Well,
so, I mean, to put that whole Prism Arena episodic tale in perspective, I'd been talking about doing that since March. Like, since lockdown happened, I was like, now's the time for me to start telling this story with Untold and Prism Arena. And it just kind of kept slipping by. And that's why when NaNoWriMo was coming up, I was like, oh, this is kind of a good opportunity to force myself to get started. And that's why I kind of accidentally dropped the seed with Michael.
Accidentally, with air quotes. All right, you can find Hub Games at wearehubgames.com or on most of the socials at wearehubgames. Or you can hit up Rory on Twitter at Rory O'Connor. What about us, Anitra? Where can you find us?
Well, you can find us at our website, thefamilygamers.com, or on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and maybe YouTube at FamilyGamersAA. I don't think we have enough people for...
We're not popular enough on YouTube yet, but we're getting there. Or you can just email us. You can always email me, Andrew, at thefamilygamers.com.
Anitra at thefamilygamers.com. You can always post questions or work on answering other people's questions in the Family Gamers community.
Which Rory is a part of.
Yes.
So I was going to suggest people could just tag me in there with a question as well.
Yeah, that is another great way to get a hold of Rory. At Rory will probably pull him up. And you can get there by just searching the Family Gamers community on Facebook or going to thefamilygamers.com/community.
You can check out our merch. We have t-shirts that say Family Gamers. We have t-shirts that say Play Games With Your Kids.
We have cool designs. They don't just say stuff.
Yes.
They look cool, too.
They do look cool. Big heart made with meeples and stuff, and I love it.
It's the best.
Hoodies, mugs, tote bags like NPR.
Covering all of our bases. Yes, head over to thefamilygamers.com/merch to check that out. I was talking to our designer today. We're getting some more stuff on there pretty soon.
Yes, I'm excited for that. Please do not forget to subscribe to this podcast if you haven't already. Tell your friends about it and leave us a review, whether you use Apple Podcasts or some other subscription source. Reviews help get our name out there to more prospective listeners.
Yep, and we would really, really appreciate that. You can also find us on Amazon Music, on TuneIn, on Stitcher, on Spotify, on your smart speaker.
Yes.
Ask it to play the Family Gamers podcast.
The Family Gamers are sponsored by First Move Financial. Go to firstmovefinancial.com/familygamers to learn how the team at First Move Financial can help you pile up the victory points.
So Rory, thanks again for coming on the show. We really appreciate you coming on. It's always a pleasure to see you. I can't wait to see you in person. Hopefully, maybe sometime in 2021. Maybe.
Maybe near the end of 2021.
I'd love to get the PAX unplugged. I think
that's our target. Yeah, that's the one we're shooting for. All right, well, that is going to be it for us this week.
Until next week,
play games with your kids.